There are five primary stages of grieving that you need to know about, and they're typically recognized by professionals worldwide. They are disbelief, yearning, anger, depression, and acceptance. Now, why is it important to actually have this information? Well, it can help prevent someone from being swallowed up in depression. And when somebody loses somebody they care about deeply, it cuts them to the heart. And if they're not careful, they will be trapped in an endless cycle of depression. And depression itself can change an individual from being an effervescent personality to one who spends countless hours alone, just endless tears. Second thing, it allows us to better serve others who are grieving. If you're grieving, you know, that's great. It's for you. But a lot of times, we're not the one grieving. It's somebody we love and we care about. And we don't know what to do. Well, part of the reason we don't know what to do is because we don't know really what's going on. We stand aloof. We want to say something. We're afraid to say something. We're afraid to do something. Well, you can't really be as effective as you want to be if you don't understand the five stages of grieving. And thirdly, it can prepare us to design a more effective means in dealing with grief. When we're coming up with a plan, whether it be for us, a ministry, reaching out to those who are grieving or who will be grieving, or to help prepare us in the future for when we're not here and our children and our loved ones are grieving, you can't really be that effective if you don't know those five stages. You're just grabbing at things in the wind, and hopefully it turns out okay. Well, here are the five stages of grief, a little bit of discussion on them. First of all, disbelief. You've noticed early on when a loved one passes or somebody you know, it doesn't even have to be a loved one. It could be a friend. It could be an acquaintance. People tend to say things like, you know, I just saw him the other day. Or that guy was just there. You know what I'm talking about. Before Jen and I went down to Florida, I had gone to see my doctor, he's 48-year-old, and I saw him 2 days before, and I came back, and I went to get a prescription filled, and I found out he died 2 days after I saw him. 48 years old. Went home, died of a heart attack. It kind of threw me back. You know, and I wouldn't consider him a loved one. I consider him an acquaintance. But, I mean, doctors, they're supposed to live to be 85 or 90, you know, and not this one. And I immediately said to Jana when I found out, I said, I just saw him 2 days before he died. You know, we were just talking about, you know, going to the gym, and he was even talking about maybe coming to church sometime because of some of the things we were talking about. That's disbelief. When someone we love passes on, we simply cannot initially accept that this person is dead. Because once you die, that's a new experience for people you love. Because they only know you as living. But now you're dead. And it's so alien, we just simply don't believe it. And then the yearning stage is a deep longing to have that person back in their life. It's that cut to the heart that says, you know, that these patterns that I'm used to are broken. It can be the time that the husband always came back from work at the same time. Or it could be that time where the wife always had the meal prepared at a specific time. Or mom was always there for this sporting event. Or the child was always waking up and getting ready for school at this time. It's when patterns are broken. And they remind us of something that makes our heart grow fonder. It becomes a thirst that simply cannot be easily quenched. That's a yearning. And then anger. Naturally, anger is a early coping mechanism to be put forth. It can be anger at oneself for not being with that person in their hour of need. It can be anger of a guilty party in a wrong death. Often to those who are lacking in faith or very weak in faith, it's anger toward God You've seen that before. God, how could you do this? Then could also be anger directed at the one who's dead. I knew somebody who had died in a car wreck. I remember the wife saying, how could you do this to me? How could you leave me with these kids? How could you leave me alone? And the guy is dead. Anger, definitely a stage we pass through. And then depression. When a person has passed through disbelief to reality, from yearning to confirmed absence, and anger as well, then there's no justification. It just doesn't seem right. Depression is sure to follow. The human mind is both strong and fragile. Emotions can cripple the thought process, and mental implosion ensues. It's a crucial phase. Any prolonging here can lead to a worsening of a mental state and a deadly cycle for the destruction of the individual. And then finally, acceptance, number five. It's the pinpoint of acquiescence. It's submission to the facts of reality. It's here that true healing is underway and resolve is in place. Though the death of a loved one can still hurt and cause lapse into tears and moments of tremendous struggle, it is not enduring. And as time passes, so does the continued acceptance of the loss of a loved one. They will survive and have true strength and weakness. Yale Bereavement Study. Yale University. It was a three-year study examining 233 individuals back in 2007. These individuals suffered loss of a loved one. They were studied in great detail. The study went on to conclude the following. Let me read you some of these. If a person has not moved through the first four stages in 6 months, he or she may need professional help dealing with the bereavement. If you have not reached acceptance in 6 months, this may be bigger than you, and you need outside help. Disbelief reached a peak after 1 month of loss, then declined. Usually, by the time a month goes by, they've at least said, you know, I know he's not here. I know she's not here. Yearning steadily increased and reached a high point at 4 months before declining. The yearning process of those moments are not there. That cut to your heart, they should begin to subside after 4 months. Except anger peaks at 5 months, and then depression peaks at 6 months. Acceptance is strongly present even before from the first, but becomes ever more dominant as time passes. The Yale study also found that the survivors tend to be better able to deal with their grief when the loved one was diagnosed with a terminal illness, and they were able to adjust to that death prior to the loved one succumbing. But if they died in an accident, if one died unexpectedly, Yale study said that they would have a much, much harder time dealing with that grief. There was no adjustment. It was a cold dive into the icy waters, and it takes a while. The shock can be there. It also said people have a harder time dealing with grief, not only when they're unexpectedly, but when they're not used to death, when they haven't been prepared in other ways. As well, you know, somebody had like a couple of deaths prior, they've been to this. If they're brand new, it's going to be a lot harder for them. Particularly in a society where we have distanced ourselves from death, where in the older society, where the families did the body preparation, and a lot of cultures where the family is involved with the funeral, you know, they see death up close. We hire professionals. We go to beautifully prepared homes away from our home. We distance ourselves from that, and in the end, it's really actually extended the grieving process. 10 to 15% of the bereaved survivors in a study experienced prolonged grief for more than 6 months. It's believed that they had a deeper dependent relationship on that individual. The person made them feel more safe and secure, and the absence of that has kicked up higher waves of grief for them. And they also conclude that people suffering from prolonged grief may have trouble working, may be at risk for other problems such as high blood pressure, suicidal thoughts, excessive drinking, and smoking. The death of a loved one, they said, actually can lead to death of the survivor. How many times have we seen that happen in our lifetimes? One husband or wife goes, shortly thereafter the husband or wife follows them. I once knew a man and a woman, man and wife, named Harold and Leola. And we had known them for many, many years. And they were married for 61 years. And they were in Sioux City, Iowa. And the husband was with the wife. She was diagnosed with cancer. They had said that she wouldn't live long. And sure enough, she was in for surgery. They said it's not going to go well. They sewed her back up. She died right there in the hospital room while he was there. And Harold walked out and collapsed in the hall and died. Both dead within 1 minute. His heart was broken. They had no children. That's all they had was each other. And the initial shock was too much. They were both buried at the same funeral. Let's look at these five steps of grieving through 2 Samuel chapter 1. I want you to see him up close. Walk through the shoes of David. See how he experienced it. Open your Bibles up to 2 Samuel chapter 1. We're going to cover all 27 verses. But we'll get through it. Beginning at verse 1. Now it came about after the death of Saul, when David had returned from the slaughter of the Amalekites, that David remained 2 days in Ziklag. And on the third day, behold, a man came out of the camp of Saul with his clothes torn and dust on his head. And it came about when he came to David that he fell on the ground and prostrated himself. Then David said to him, "From whence do you, where do you come?" And he said to him, "I have escaped from the camp of Israel." David said to him, "How did things go? Please tell me." This is the first sign of disbelief for David. Being a great man of war, he knows how bad this battle with the Philistines was. I know they didn't have email, radio, but believe me, this big battle, he knew what was going on. There would be many, many people die. And he had a dear friend named Jonathan in there, the son of Saul. And he was eager to find out if he survived it. Hey, I want good news. I want to know if he survived. This is how disbelief process works. For it flies in the face of factual information. When all the information says, you're not going to like how it turns out, they still go against it. They try to find hope. This morning on Fox News, they had a lady who was in who lived in a hotel in Haiti. She was in America. I don't know if you saw this. It was very, very moving. She was from Tennessee. She was doing some research there. She was also, I think, doing some mission work. But she had lived in a hotel for a year. She knew this Haitian family very, very well. And she wasn't in the hotel the day that it collapsed. So she wasn't hurt, but she was flown out. She had a very dear friend, the owner of that hotel. And she said that she had gotten word that the husband of this woman, who she was very dear friends with, was searching for his wife, couldn't find him. They had assumed she was dead. The hotel's completely collapsed. And she found out live on television this morning that her friend wasn't dead. You should have seen it. She was saying, you know, "I have a dear friend that died," and said, "We just got word that they found this person, and she was just dehydrated. She'll be fine." And she started crying. It was confirmed to her, her dear friend was alive. She was unprepared, but she was pleasantly surprised. But she was still holding out a little hope. But a lot of times, for most of us, that hope will never come. Continuing on the passage, he said, the people have fled from the battle, and so many people have fallen and are dead. And Saul and Jonathan, his son, are dead also. And so David said to the young man who told him, how do you know that Saul and his son David, Jonathan, are dead? Here we see the next appearance of the disbelief. He called for reconfirmation of that which he already expected. It was a bad battle. He had a bad vibe about it. He's a man of war, and he knows how wars go. And he had a dear friend. He had skin in the game, as they might say. When he found out that Saul and Jonathan were dead, how do you know? How do you know? I want to know. You better get these facts straight. Please don't confirm it for me, because I don't want to know this person is dead. That's the disbelief. Have you had a loss in your family before, or you had a friend die? You know what that's like. When you say, no, it's not that. No, check the facts. Check it again. Check it again. David's going through this very step of grieving. And this young man who told him said, by chance I happened to be on Mount Gilboa, and behold, Saul was leaning on his spear, and behold, the chariots and the horsemen pursued him closely. When he looked behind him, he saw me and called to me and said, here I am. And he said to me, who are you? And I answered him, I am an Amalekite. He said to me, please stand beside me and kill me, for agony has seized me, because my life still lingers in me. So I stood beside him and killed him, because I knew that he could not live after he had fallen. And I took the crown which was on his head and the bracelet which was on his arm, and I brought them here to my Lord. Then David took off his clothes and tore them, and did all that all the men did the same. And they mourned and they wept and they fasted until evening for Saul and his son Jonathan, and for all the people of the Lord in the house of Israel, because they had fallen by the sword. Let the yearning process begin. It's been doubly confirmed now. The very one who was an eyewitness and a participant to a Dr. Kevorkian moment. It's confirmed. They're in sackcloth and ashes, fasting. When they hurt, you know, a lot of times when somebody you love dies, you're not even hungry. It's like God says, I'm going to help you with this fast. You don't want to do anything. You're just in disarray. This is the yearning process. You realize that David's saying, I don't have a relationship with my beloved friend Jonathan anymore. His actions declare a deep yearning for Jonathan. Verse 13, David said to the young man who told him, where are you from? He said, I am the son of an alien and an Amalekite. And David said to him, how is it you are not afraid to stretch forth your hand toward the Lord's anointed? David called one of the young men and said, go cut him down. And he struck him and he died. And David said to him, your blood is on your head, and your mouth has testified against you, saying, I have killed the Lord's anointed. Can you guess what stage he's in now? That's right, anger. We're introduced to a bit of the anger stage. Someone's going to pay for this. Someone's responsible for this. I'm going to get vengeance. Somebody's going to be clobbered for what they've done. My friend is dead, and it's not going to go unpunished. The man was just trying to help, but he became a guilty party. So deep anger that resulted in the execution of a man. How many times when we suffered through grief did we say, how could that person do that? It must be the manufacture of the car. It must be the way the road was made. It must be the doctor's fault. We want to blame somebody because it hurts and we're angry. And David's angry as well. Well, let's bring on a little depression and acceptance. Remember, all five of these can hit at the same time. And that's why death hurts so bad, because you're struggling to sort these out. You don't know. Every emotion hits you. Listen to what David did. Then David chanted with this lament over Saul and Jonathan, his son. He told them to teach the sons of Judah the song of the bow. Behold, it is written in the book of Jasher. Think of depression and acceptance throughout this song, this lament. Your beauty, O Israel, is slain on your high places. How have the mighty fallen? Tell it not in Gath. Proclaim it not on the streets of Ashkelon. For the daughters of the Philistines will rejoice. The daughters of the uncircumcised will exult. O mountains of Gilboa, let not dew or rain be on you, nor fields of offerings. For there the shield of the mighty was defiled. Shield of Saul, not anointed with oil. From the blood of the slain, from the fat of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan did not turn back. The sword of Saul did not return empty. Saul and Jonathan, beloved and pleasant in their life, and in their death they were not parted. They were swifter than eagles and stronger than lions. O daughters of Israel, weep over Saul, who clothed you luxuriously in scarlet, who put ornaments of gold on your apparel. How have the mighty fallen in the midst of battle? Jonathan is slain on your high places. I am distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. You have been very pleasant to me. Your love to me was more wonderful than the love of women. How have the mighty fallen? The weapons of war perished. There's a man struggling with depression and acceptance. We see both in this lament. The depression stage, there's a dwelling of depression through repeating and reliving this tragedy, how bad it is, multiple times. Mighty have fallen. Many times they're called to weep and to mourn, and yet the accepting stage is an acceptation of the outcome. They fought brilliantly and with honor. Words such as love, pleasant, swift, and strong are permanently etched in the reader's mind as well as the mind of David. They left the world a better place than they found it. David was left with the mention of a deep brotherly love for Jonathan. This is accepting stage at its best. When you come to some resoluting factor that will come back and comfort you and allow you to grow, both we find in the same psalm, the lament. It's written, as he said, in the book of Jasher. We must understand the five stages of grief are real and can be applied to our everyday lives. This is how God designed it for us. It's for us humans to pass through this pattern. If you have a brain, if you have DNA, if you're part of God's creation, if you're in the human experience, welcome to where God will take you, the five stages of grief. He also designed for us not to pass through these stages alone, but to share the experience with others. God didn't design for us to grieve alone. Think about this as you struggle with your grief. I want to close with this story. At the end of the story, if you want to respond to the invitation, if you're hurting in such a way over the death of somebody that you love, if you're struggling with the grief process, if you want encouragement from your brothers or sisters in this grieving process, we had some that responded last week. We had some others that said they wanted to respond. We're here for you. We share your struggle. Meditate on this closing story. If you're hurt in that way, we want you to come forward so that we might be enlisted in your grief. Let us take one of the stages of grief from you. Jennifer was a young stay-at-home mother with a 2-year-old and a newborn to care after. She was a good mom, being attentive to her children's needs, making the sacrifices that made a difference. She was also a multitasker, a valuable asset to the home. One day while cleaning the kitchen, with a bucket and a mop, the baby began to cry and the phone started to ring. Within a moment, the baby was on her left hip and the phone was up to the right side of her head. She was planning an afternoon get-together with another mom from the neighborhood. She was jotting a note on a piece of paper. She heard a small splash and turned to see what it was. She was horrified to find her 2-year-old son, Michael, buried head first in a cleaning bucket, thrashing his little legs and trying to gain upright. Apparently, he had tried to stick his hand in the cleaning water. My mom turned her back just for a couple minutes. She immediately set her infant down, screaming for fear and hoping for the best. She pulled his convulsing body from the bucket, found that he was not breathing. She immediately called 911, tried to revive him. By the time the paramedics arrived, she could see it was too late. Inhaling the chemicals from the bucket had sentenced that little boy to a quick death. He was pronounced dead at the hospital an hour and a half later. By the time Jim, her husband and father, had arrived at the hospital just in time to hear the pronouncement of death, what started out as a happy family of four at the beginning of the day had ended in complete tragedy. Yes. Jennifer and Jim cried in each other's arms as the coroner took the body. Their baby was gone. By the time they reached home, many family and friends were already waiting to comfort and assist. All their hearts were broken, but none above the parents. They exhibited early stages of disbelief by repeatedly saying things like, "He was just here, and this must be some sort of nightmare, and I can't believe this is happening to us." All I could do was weep as their loved ones shared their grief and sorrow. The pain was too much to bear. It was an amazing thought they were even able to have an hour's worth of rest that night. That's what you can call it, rest. First night was filled with countless visits to the toddler's room for nurturing that would not occur. This went on for days, weeks, and months. Sometimes they actually thought they could hear the child at night, but would find out it's only phantom cries from a child they longed for. Jim used to tuck young Michael in for prayer at night, but that was gone. He missed this so much. Just the sight of his car seat back in the USV brought great tears to their eyes. They were going through a deep yearning stage. And through all this were the moments of anger. They had anger at each other, anger with themselves, anger toward the friend who called on the phone that day, anger with the paramedic's slowness. Most of all, there was anger with God. How could he let this happen to their little boy? He had done all the right things, yet little Michael was gone. All this going on, it wasn't surprising to find many periods of depression that would come and go. Sometimes Jennifer would lay in bed at night or lay in bed during her days off, just staring at the stucco on the ceiling and think. At one point, the depression became so great that she went on some medication to help her collect her composure. Through many weeks of therapy with a counselor, fellowship with a church family, and meditation unto God, they were finally able to begin somewhat of a normal life. There were times that they would slip back into the cycle. By having a good plan of action, they were able to finally gain acceptance with their grief. There's a lot of people like that who have somebody they love that died. Why don't you let us help you with that grief? Think about that.